Today's story is about helping others. Sometimes it can be so rewarding, you know, teaching a kid to read, helping someone buy something they really need. But sometimes helping others can feel like the Greek myth of Sisyphus. In the story of Sisyphus, he's condemned to rolling a heavy boulder up a hill and then watching it fall back down again for all eternity. Roll it up, watch it fall down. A true exercise in futility. So in the vein of Greek mythology, I went to the Parthenon. You know, that's the life-size replica, at least, the one in Centennial Park in Nashville. There next to the temple that houses a 42-foot-high statue of Athena, I tried to get to know my neighbors. I asked random people in the park this. Have you ever tried to help someone and it seemed pointless?
Oh, not that I can come up with.
Nothing right now?
No.
That's all right.
I don't think so.
Okay, well, it was 30 degrees outside. I finally got one lady to open up.
We had a very cute fellow, homeless fellow, some money in Memphis.
And how did he react?
He was good. It was great. Yeah. We couldn't find a restaurant. Nobody can find Rendezvous, apparently. And he helps everybody.
Awesome. Yeah. So he helped you find a restaurant?
Yes. Huh. Yeah. Awesome. It didn't backfire. Sorry. It was all good.
All right. This whole exercise was starting to feel pointless. But then I met John, who is an activities director for seniors.
I think of a man at a nursing home near where I work that his health was failing so much he just didn't have the energy, you know, and the drive to be very responsive. So no matter what, you know, I tried to tap into all of his interests. You know, he was from Austria, and I tried to bring in, you know, specialties of the food in Austria, and I brought in pictures and maps of where he was born, and I tried to play music. He loved classical music, and I just, you know, I hit a wall. And I really, you know, and the family was super appreciative, but they understood that he just, you know, he was in just such discomfort with, you know, aches and pains that he had that he just kind of couldn't focus.
So here's my question to that. Was it futile?
No, because I know on some level he appreciated, you know, the attention that he was getting. He appreciated the effort, and he would apologetically say, you know, I'm just tired. You know, I know you're trying, and these are neat things that I may once have enjoyed, but I'm just tired and my head's unable to focus and stuff.
And then I met the crown jewel of my frigid time at the Parthenon, Jesse, a man sitting content on a bench, throwing peanuts to squirrels.
Now my son's tried to help the lady with, she lost a car and towed it away, and he helped her get another one and was making friends, and she decided that she didn't want to be friends any longer, I guess, and after she got her another car.
Gotcha. So did he help pay for it?
Well, yeah.
And then she just turned tail and ran.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, I don't know. A lot of things in life don't turn out like you'd like them to, but I like to do things like feed the squirrels and stuff like that that makes me feel good inside. And so I better quit and answer my phone. It's ringing.
Thanks,
so
Jesse.
You have a nice day and a happy new year.
You too. Happy New Year. I'm Jacob Lewis, and you're listening to Neighbors, the show where next door hits home. Today's story, I'm just trying to help. Neighbors contributor Tasha A.F. Limley has a story about a woman whose job it is to roll the stone up the hill, even if she's pretty sure it's just going to come right back down again.
One morning in the hospital, he wiggles a big toe. This is kind of like in a movie. And then he gets back feeling in his legs and slowly regains control of his bladder. Over the next couple of weeks, Alan starts being able to shuffle around with a walker. And there's this one day in the bathroom. He doesn't mean to, but he lets go. and he finds himself standing on his own.
Something told me to let go, and I let go. And I was amazed. I sat back down on the toilet and started to cry. And praising God the whole time. It was an extremely emotional experience.
I can't imagine. That's amazing.
Well, you want to find out for yourself, go out there and jump in that lake.
No, thank you.
That's me with Alan. And it's hard to hear, but if you listen really closely, there's someone else chuckling in the background.
Jump in that lake.
That's Lisa. For 20 years, she had a really great corporate job. She was making about $100,000 a year. And she was even going to be able to retire in her 40s. But she was just done. So she left all of that. She wanted to be with people like Alan. So now, she's Reverend Lisa Cook, a second career minister.
Yes, I am a recently ordained minister in the Cumberland Presbyterian tradition.
When she was in school, Lisa drove enough miles between her home in Nashville and seminary in Memphis to circle the globe twice. This whole time, she's got a lot of time to think. She's wrestling with what she was going to do once she got ordained. She honestly had no idea. But she started getting some clarity about it just 4 months before graduation. And then she gets the courage to say it out loud. She wanted to be a pastor to people who lived outside, a street chaplain.
Meaning that I don't have a brick and mortar church, but my church is the congregation, consisting of some of the homeless men and women that I am in relationship with currently.
So she founded Sacred Sparks Ministry, a really tiny organization, and her life is way different now. In fact, the only thing the same is that she still drives a lot and goes through a lot of fuel. Everything else has changed.
You're taking me home some magic way.
No, I'm just talking, and getting into what I'm talking about, and I'm taking you to my house.
Lisa only gets a living stipend of $12,000 a year from her denomination. And don't get me wrong, she's incredibly grateful for that. She wasn't expecting anything when she went into this. But it obviously pales in comparison to what she was making before. That $12,000 has to go a long way. It has to pay for her basic needs and a little bit of that gas that she uses driving around, seeing people and taking them places. So she depends on people to give her money so that she can buy her new equivalent of office supplies. Lisa goes through stuff like adult diapers, fuel for camping stoves, and even the occasional cheap hotel room. This is a big change from corporate work. Her old job defined success really clearly, but now success is pretty muddy.
When I founded Sacred Sparks, I look back now and I kind of laugh because I thought, okay, I'll have this set schedule. I thought I could make an agenda out of this job, and I quickly learned that was not going to be how I would roll as a street chaplain. And there's always needs. And so my job, I think, and what I really appreciate my education preparing me for, is how to prioritize those needs. Because a lot of times when you're in the situations that a lot of the people that I'm in relationship with are in, everything is an emergency. Just because of the way you have to live your life day in and day out.
One of these people is Alan.
My name is Alan Paul DeCray. I'm 63.
He turned 63 in the hospital.
Alan had already been in a cycle of homelessness and recovery for 18 years by the time he met Lisa last winter. They became friends. And at one point, he'd been sober for over a month, and he'd even started applying for apartments. But three of them rejected him in one day. So he gave up, and he started drinking again. And then he disappeared. Until one really cold night.
And he called me in the middle of it. And I told him as soon as I got everybody squared away, I'd come pick him up. And the one thing I thought about that night was a scripture about the lost sheep. And it just kept going over and over in my head. Because I wasn't supposed to leave the shelter. I mean, I left the shelter with some good people at Brent Haven, but I'm the one that they trust to be there. But I left and went and got Alan, and I kept thinking about this scripture from John about the lost sheep and how the shepherd leaves all these sheep to go find this one that's lost. And And I just kept telling people, you know, how could I not leave the 15 sheep that I had at church and not go find this lost one? And I found him, and I got him into rehab, and we have been tight and inseparable almost since then.
Working together, they finally got him that apartment. 2 months in, so far so good. Alan's nesting. He's being surrounded by community. Things are looking up. And he was invited to a men's retreat at a lake out of town. Alan's relaxing in a boat. He's feeling great. And everybody else is having a good time, too. Especially one group. They're jumping off a 40-foot cliff into the water. Alan thinks that looks pretty fun, and he wants to try it out himself. Lisa's phone buzzes. It was her birthday.
And I get a text from him that said that he has jumped into the water and he can't feel anything below his knees. And tests revealing that he had broken his back pretty severely, resulting in a 2.5-hour emergency surgery that same night, where a doctor, a neurosurgeon, in the words of the doctor, put him back together with 2 rods and 4 screws and removed a piece of a broken vertebrae that was pressing against his spinal cord, resulting in the paralysis that he experienced. He was told by that doctor that he would never walk again, that everything below the waist was pretty much out of play.
So Alan is paralyzed, and there's little hope of any continued care. But this is a necessity for recovery from an injury like this. So he's basically a homeless guy, no insurance and no money. But he's got friends.
And the good for me right now in this situation is how the community came together and surrounded Alan. And he's at Southern Hills thanks to the CEO of that hospital, who offered Alan a room there for as long as he needed, the therapy that he needs, free of charge. You know, I often try to practice not asking why bad things happen. You know, and why Alan would have this happen when he was in such a really good place. And I try to find, I don't always succeed, but I try to be intentional about finding the good in these situations instead of trying to pick apart the bad.
2 weeks after the surgery, Alan's transported back to Nashville and he begins intensive inpatient rehab. He starts feeling stronger and he starts getting some hope, despite what his surgeon told him.
When I asked him, does that mean I won't walk again? He said, not likely. He said, you may be able to stand, but I doubt you'll be able to walk.
So you've already proven him wrong?
Most definitely. My next step is to walk on my own.
5.5 weeks after his accident, Lisa takes Alan back to his apartment.
Will you wait and let me get this up there and then I'll come behind you?
Yeah, I need to.
I know.
Stretch my legs a little bit.
Lisa carries his wheelchair to the top of the stairs. Impatient and standing, Alan pulls himself up the banister to his second floor apartment.
You didn't wait.
Wait for what?
For me.
I can't wait down there.
The first thing on the sheet says, don't do this without somebody with you.
Okay. Well.
Lisa runs downstairs to get Alan's keys. He wheels himself down the hallway, and he waits to open his door.
Lisa, where are you?
Here she comes.
Let me do the honors.
All right.
Lisa hands him the keys.
Ta-da!
So Alan's back at home. A relationship with Lisa begins on the street, but her job's not done when someone is no longer technically without a house. It's tempting to see housing as the quote happy ending, the neat and clean conclusion to everyone's hard work. Well, this just isn't true. The transition is not that simple. Lisa sometimes compares housing to a death. When someone dies, there's a party of sorts, just like when someone's life on the street ends. And like a funeral, after the ceremony, most people are gone, back to their lives. And that's where the real work starts for the people left alone. Not only is Alan literally learning to walk again, he's just come off the streets. He's an addict, and he's living alone for the first time in a really long time. The good thing is he's indoors now, but the better news is he has a few friends like Lisa to keep walking with him through his challenges.
I quit many times, but never for a sustained period of time. Now I met Lisa, and they asked me if I'd go to treatment for 30 days, and I said, whatever it takes. And believe it or not, I'm glad this accident happened. It has really opened my eyes to what God is all about. My faith is off the planet. I mean, it's just somewhere between Jupiter and Mars by now.
As grateful as Alan is, independence and solitude are a tough combination, especially when trying to stay clean. Since the accident, Alan hasn't been able to get to AA meetings for weeks, and now even though he has the ability, it's not easy to go. At the hospital, he had 24-hour care, a lot of attention, and access to tightly regulated pain medication. So now he's also got the void of no longer having full-time help with pain management. Unfortunately, Alan has succumbed to that void. He's abusing prescription medication. He's hooked up with an old drinking buddy, and he started drinking again.
It struck me that, you know, I had thought selfishly and felt bad about it that if he did have the urge to drink, that he would not be able to get to anything easily. And he had found a way to easily get to whatever he wanted, and he just let his friends be his legs for him. And he just gave the money, and this guy would walk and get whatever he wanted and bring it right back to his door.
Even though she's concerned and really frustrated, Lisa says she's not surprised. She understands addiction, and she knew the likelihood of a relapse. She also knows Alan has a choice to make now, between sobriety and addiction, between continuing to heal from his injury and getting a lot worse, between the community around him and the alcohol. And like Alan said, he can choose to die or he can choose to live once again. There's no choice in between. Their relationship has taken a hit in the meantime. She says it's stunted and bruised by Alan's deceptive and destructive behavior. That said, Lisa knew what she was in for when she met him, and she's still in this for the long haul.
You know, a pastoral relationship is very much like a parent-child relationship almost sometimes, where they can disappoint you, but there's nothing they can do that would ever make you cut ties completely. If Alan had not stopped drinking and they kicked him out of his apartment and he ends up in the abandoned trailer that he lived in, then I will be going to East Nashville to see Alan and to make sure he's okay and to let him know that somebody still loves him. That's my role, is to let him know that he's loved.
Back at her old job, Lisa used to be able to figure out her success based on her yearly review and her measurable achievements. But these days, her success just can't be dependent on black and white things like that, like someone's sobriety or housing status. The only stable measure of success now is that she loves unconditionally, and this is regardless of what someone else does or how disappointed she is in them. This sounds pretty selfless, and she gets a lot of praise for her work. But Lisa feels the need to push back whenever she's given too much credit.
I try to be so intentional on never, never saying that any of this is me. I don't take credit for anything I do. That scares me to death to take credit for anything I do. I have to keep reminding people. You know, by virtue of what I do, you get a lot of, oh, you do such good work, and you're such a good person, and I don't know how you do what you do. And I tell them, I'm like, this is not what, Lisa is not doing this. God is doing this through Lisa. I knew the Lisa before God was in Lisa's life, and she wasn't worth a damn.
There's no shortage of people needing Lisa's help and attention. And a lot seem to think that she's a natural in this role. But like any new job, I guess it just takes some time to get balanced and to find confidence.
I still, to this day, have no idea why God has called me to do anything in ministry. And it's such a feeling of unworthiness to be in a position where you minister to and people look at you as a spiritual leader. Is such an intimidating role that I still, to this day, wonder if God knocked on the wrong door sometimes.
That's the show. Special thanks to Tasha. I'm putting a link to Sacred Sparks Ministry on neighborspodcast.com. If you like the show, leave us a review in iTunes. It goes a long way to getting us noticed. I'm Jacob Lewis, and I'm reminding you to get to know your neighbors.